Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Conecuh Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a program entitled Bohemian Girl, An Evening with Author Teresa Svoboda. This event was held in partnership with the Downtown Omaha Lit Fest. Ms. Svoboda will be heard in conversation with Timothy Shaffert, Nebraska author, and a member of the faculty in the Department of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday evening, October 15, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Conecuh, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Timothy Shaffert.
I'm so very happy to have with us tonight Teresa Svoboda, who's launching her new book, Bohemian Girl, here at the Downtown Omaha Lit Fest. Teresa, as many of you know, is a native Nebraskan, and it's also the topic of her work. Teresa is a poet, a novelist, a filmmaker, a digital artist. She was working on a cell phone fiction when I last talked to her a couple of years ago. She's written a libretto for an opera, and it's sort of I could spend all night introducing her because she's published so much and has earned so many accolades over the years. But I do want to read this quote from Kurt Anderson, since he's a friend of public radio and we have KLS with us tonight. Bohemian Girl is beautiful and believable and altogether wonderful. Teresa Svoboda has transmuted a familiar story and setting and character types into a fine and movingly original piece of fiction that I'm still haunted by. She will, of course, be compared to Willa Cather, and deservedly so. And so please welcome Teresa Svoboda. Teresa's going to read from Bohemian Girl, and then we're going to have a little conversation, and I hope you'll ask some questions afterwards as well.
So I'm going to read from chapter 19 of this book, way in the middle, which is a chapter that celebrates the statehood of Nebraska. I thought maybe you'd relate to it in some way. It was 1867, and our heroine, I think it begins in 1861, and has had many adventures up to this point, but she's settled into a town and is influential in the event. To celebrate the statehood, women lay dozens of pies, meat and fruit, on one end of the table in town, pushed together, and lever kegs of drink onto the other end. The men are forced to bathe for the event, which they maintain is truly ridiculous. How is a bath political? Their wives and mothers trim their mustaches and beards and polish their buttons and find shoes for them that make them look as if they had marched into churches instead of battles. Many of the men take to giving and receiving kisses while all this is being done, some of the statehood beer having been leaked from the kegs. Thus the women are reminded of how much they missed them while they were warring, and how fearful they were falls out on their lips, or else they get short with them, with all their feelings laid out like that. I remember the drummer boy at the fort, and turn a cracker tin into a drum that the shortest of the veterans takes. But I have to show him how to hold the sticks I have smoothed. I have to beat out a rat-tat-tat for him. Oh, I only stole cattle, he tells me. I was good for that, and as a prisoner. He doesn't have the soldier's disease, wanting only to smoke ground wild poppy, and he turns out to be one of the best eaters. I am shocked by how many of the returnees do not match their relatives' descriptions. Some of it is their size. Described as barrel-chested, the man turns up deflated, unstaved. Do the women or the children or the old parent remember them wrong? The cheerful ones sing melancholy airs, and the melancholy tell jokes. A rogue brother appears out of the prairie for the party, and he is so steadied out of his usual ways that his sister takes him in with not so much as a toodaloo. Even more shocking are the women and the children who stayed and starved, whom the men don't recognize. But all of the men congratulate themselves on themselves surviving, backslapping and cajoling, as if survival is solely on their own account. Must be the strongest and cleverest, that family of six boys, all of them back. But one look, and you see that none of them could muster the courage to flush a woodpile for badgers. But not all of the returnees feign bravery. Some of the bravest could be wearing skirts. They fear even the sound of the axe, let alone the blast of the cannon that plenty shoot off for the statehood, the band playing in between volleys. Some of them can't figure out why they came back at all and parade with their arms stiff at their sides and not around their wives. Others lift half-grown calves to show off what strength they returned with. A couple are loud about the women they fought off elsewhere, but all of them, brave or not, volunteered. That the statehood struggled to pass, having senators wanting to keep the vote to those of their own race, until the president himself put in his objection, is nothing they want to discuss. I am glad the slaves are free. She's a slave early in the book. Before all the feasting, we play croquet in the wheat stubble, the cut rows making it harder on the cross shots, but easier to hit the balls home. Every step rains grasshoppers. Afterwards, the horses throw off their shoes in the heat, and two men compete, throwing them at stakes beside the weighted tables, even heavier now that they're laden with slow-roasted haunches and the parts of chickens. All this food is remembered by count for decades, so many mock apple pies, so many legs of beef, and enough secret bottles and flasks besides the kegs under the table that no one knows how all the speeches, also counted, were ever finished. Men with sashes cut from cloth in colors so gaudy I couldn't sell them anyway, stand and repeat themselves in the style of the day, ornately, with a vigor of new affirmation. Listeners beat their spoons at every Grand Army of the Republic. But louder when the dead president's name greets their ears as the choice for the new state capitals, 2 days ride away. Even Henry rises and tells about his serving the country as a cook. First he warms up the subject with On Gortum Moor, the great hunger that brought him and his mother over from their country, shorn of their every relative, and how this spread of food here proves he emigrated for the good. He pokes his hand out toward the fly-laden empty rashers and scraped tin pots, and how half the shave-tails he fought with weren't speakers of English at all, but had struck the continent with about the same luck he had at about the same time, one war or another being what they were really good for, except for the eating. Old tar, they called me, he says, on account of the supplies I used, and of course the taste of my cooking. Someone tells him to sit down. He is putting the fear of the food into them. And for the first time, I see a smile split his whiskers.
Thank you so much.
And that's from Bohemian Girl, which is new out from University of Nebraska Press. Therese also has another new novel. I mean, you have to call it new because it's been not even a year since it came out, Pirate Talk.
Yeah, Pirate Talk or Mermelade.
Yeah. Another of your novels is Tin God, which is also set in Nebraska. And you had a memoir. The title is Black Glasses Like Clark Kent, which the New York Post called astounding. Your first novel is called A Female Heart of Darkness. The novel was Cannibal, and that was a quote from Vogue. Publishers Weekly called you a fabulous fabulist. Is that how you regard your work? Do you think of yourself as a fabulist or a fantasist. I mean, certainly the language plays a part, I think, in that kind of label. Certainly your background with poetry certainly inspires the words to kind of carry the story away at times, I think, in a good way, not away as in off. but I think that there's definitely a sense of magic that's conveyed by the language itself.
Well, fabulous, of course. But, you know, I subscribe to Nabokov's theory that there are reported stories and there are just stories, and then there's enchantment, and I aim for the enchantment. I, of course, don't find them so fabulous. I think that it's all very clear and everything happens rather normally. I guess that's a reflection of me.
Well, what were the origins of Bohemian Girl? How did that come to be?
Well, it was originally called Flat Platt, which I grew up next to the Platte River, as many people did, and was intrigued by a body of water that was too thick to plow and too thin to drink. No, too thin to drink, too thick to plow. Anyway, and it was always imagined as a causeway between other states, that it was going to really bring us and make us a major player in navigational access to the rest of the country, but that didn't happen. And so then slowly the story kind of turned on Willa Cather. And so the young girl makes a long trek and ends up near the Republican River. So geography had a lot to do with it.
Did you say geography had a lot to do with it? And landscape? And
yes.
And so, okay, now how did you find your way to the Republic River, like, in your imagination?
Well, there were several. She walks a long time. Okay. I spent a year in South Sudan in my more formative part of my life, and so I experienced what it would be like in a place that was technologically very primitive, and so I transposed some of that experience to Harriet's Walk.
Okay. And so how did you research the novel? How did you go about placing yourself in that world, in that place?
Well, I did. I always like to write through to the end of the story so I know what I'm doing, and then I rewrite it a million times. And while I'm rewriting it, I read more and more text to confirm or to add to the material that I have, which included I researched a documentary about George Catlin 25 years ago, and some of that material is in here. Captive stories about people who were taken captive by Native Americans. Soldiers in the stockades during the Civil War in Nebraska who really didn't have anything to do. The marauding, really thieves that came in dressed in various pieces of Civil War clothing called Jayhawkers that went around southeastern Nebraska and harassed people. The Underground Railroad, there were lots of things. So the fabulous stories in here, even the two Native Americans who, in the third chapter, I think, who are having a chat about what to do about the mound-building women that they have accumulated, talk about London Bridge, because everyone then knew that London Bridge had walled up some of the workmen and the workmen's children in a kind of a magical way of keeping the bridge up, hence the song London Bridges. And they were thinking that maybe it would be a good idea to wall up a couple of the workers.
Now there's also darkness in your work.
Yes.
There's it has a haunting quality beyond just the language, but also just what happens to the characters. There are moments of violence, and there are moments of abduction. And so I guess I have this in my mind because I heard Joyce Carol Oates was talking about writing from the dark side, and she was talking about how her ultimate goal really is to speak to the soul. But and so she doesn't think of herself as a dark writer, and yet that's a phrase that gets used a lot in reviews of your work and in conversations, that acknowledgement of the twists of things that happen.
Well, I looked at those pictures of 30-year-old women who were pioneers in Nebraska, and they all looked 70 years old, and they all wrote such cheerful journals. What was that about, really? So there was, it's kind of an acknowledgement of their efforts that they made to settle the state.
And how did you research it then? I mean, how did you find this information? How did you find the diaries, I mean, and the other materials that you sought throughout the process?
Well, you know, since I started with George Catlin 25 years ago, there was, you know, material I collected as I went along. And to the extent that, well, Google, of course, was very useful, along with many books. But I was looking for phrases in 19th century speech that would make it sound authentic and lively, and but not too archaic, so you didn't understand what they were saying. So that was key, I think, into setting the experience.
Now, earlier today, we were talking about character, and you spoke about how you, if I remember correctly, you kind of felt like you write from your own point of view, essentially, and so the characters kind of evolve from that. Do the characters then linger in your mind after? I mean, but are all the characters some aspect of your point of view? Because you have certainly diverse characters doing terrible things to each other.
Well, I think any character that you write with real authenticity has to come out of your experience in some way. And if that means that you have to remember when your brother chased you with a baseball bat in order to hypothesize what it would be like to be chased by people with guns, that's quite legitimate transference of, you know, experience.
So tell us a little bit about writing about Nebraska. I mean, you don't live here anymore, but you do make it back from time to time. Mm-hmm. But clearly, in a way similar to Willa Cather, it is a landscape that has stayed with you, even though you've been away from it. Why do you keep returning to Nebraska as a subject?
Why do I return to it? Well, because...
In your work.
Two things. Thomas Wolfe says you can't go home again, but I find you can never leave. So those formative landscapes will be in your head for the rest of your life. And then when you go home, which I do visit fairly often, things... You know, the beauty of living out by Ogallala is that the sandhills are there, and they are eternal at this point. They really can't put high-rises there. So it's a continual fount of inspiration and how people continue to live there and turn it into their own fate is really fascinating.
Well, since you bring up Ogallala, and we mentioned at the opera a little earlier, the Wet... Mm-hmm. Which dealt with water and water control, is that correct?
That's right.
And we're hearing a lot about the Ogallala Aquifer lately because of the potential for threat to this valuable resource. So what role has water played in your work and in your investigation of your own kind of psychological connection to the land?
Well, there's some great mystery about having this huge body of water underfoot and everything being so dry above it. And also my father was on the NRD board for a long time, so we had some feeling for how that affected our lives. And I've been working on a series of collected rather long short stories having to do with water in this region from prehistory times, before Native Americans, the Clovis people, all the way to a sci-fi piece, which I didn't ever think I would write, because it's such a big subject, and you guys better take care of it.
In a few minutes, we'll open it up to questions when the microphone is set up, and we'll ask you to step forward with those questions so we can get you recorded. But I do want to, since you brought up your father, I want to ask you about your family, because I know your mother played a role in some of the public sculpture throughout the state as well, which I think is really interesting as someone who's driven across the interstate several times.
Well, my father pointed out that she was standing on the state capitol steps and was interviewed by the Today Show about the controversy surrounding the selection of the sculptor on the interstate. And so it remains a legendary in our family anyway.
For those who don't know, if you travel down interstate, was this in the 1970s that this project was?
60s, 70s, yeah.
Okay. You can go to the rest areas and visit public art and these amazing sculptures. And one of them, was it called Irma's Desire?
I think so.
It was controversial, it was very abstract, and yet because of the title, you can recognize that it seems to be a kind of Irma, sort of in recline and a kind of post-coital, perhaps, or seductive pose.
And see what you want.
So you grew up, so it seems like you grew up with some insights into art, perhaps.
Well, she was determined not to have horse and riders. She thought that the Nebraskans were more very sophisticated, really, in what they wanted to see. And I think that that's turned out to be true.
Yeah. And do you share that in your sense of portraiture of the state?
Well, yes, I'm not interested in romanticizing the state because I think it's a very complex place with full of people who have genuine, complicated lives that should be honored.
I do want to ask you about a piece I read when you were addressing Willa Cather and her role on in the development of Bohemian Girl, and the concept of literary theft.
Ah, yes. Well, Willa Cather's short story was called The Bohemian Girl, and it was stolen from an Irish opera that was very popular in the 19th century, who stole it from someone before that. So, O Pioneers was stolen from Walt Whitman. So there's a thievery which is both honors your predecessor and refreshes it for the generation at this time. So their thievery is part of the game. Yes.
I'm curious to know, besides Willa Cather, what other Nebraskan writers have had an influence on you, either new or old?
Well, yeah. The other day when I was interviewed in Lincoln, the interviewer had mentioned how it seemed that Mari Sandoz was more appropriate. I did write the introduction to Capital City, so I only really knew about the vices of Lincoln. But I have read Old Jewels, and it was formative. I actually read Old Jewels in my youth rather than Willa Cather. For some reason, the high school didn't have us read it. So maybe that was important. And she is also a very straight talker, Mari Sandoz, and my heroine is as well.
Yeah, I love Mari Sandoz. I suppose because my first exposure to her was through Old Jewels, which when I was young felt sort of frumpy or something. Mm-hmm. But Capital City is such a great book, and she was just such a... she's very kind of brazen and bold, mm-hmm. and, you know, controversial, mm-hmm. And outspoken, and a best-selling author, you know, extremely popular at the time, and perhaps not so widely read anymore, I mean, outside of the state.
And she actually stayed in the state. Willa moved to New York for all those years and avoided the slings and arrows of being in Nebraska and being a writer, so that was interesting.
There's a writer I love named Wright Morris. Do you know his work? He grew up in Central City, I think San Francisco claims him as one of theirs as well because he lived there so many years, but... And he came to be known primarily as a photographer, mm-hmm. but I can see he was exploring things similar to you in the way of along the lines of structure and risk and exploring different avenues of fiction writing because he was doing photo texts, mm-hmm. which nobody else was doing at the time, it wasn't being done terribly successfully because he was blending these wonderful photos of home places and Nebraska settings and weaving this tale around them at the time, which were very expensive to produce and weren't popular with his publisher. But had he been able to continue with that, you know, it would have been somewhat revolutionary, I think. But
yes, that's right. Word and image. Yeah. It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
I also am inspired by Weldon Keyes, not a very neglected Nebraskan poet in this state. I think he's better known outside of the state. And his strange, dark poetry is really so wonderful.
And his fiction's great, too. I mean, he was doing like you were doing. He was writing poetry, fiction, making films.
Yeah, that's right.
He was a jazz musician.
And a critic. He was a wonderful critic. Yeah.
And a librarian. He's a librarian in Beatrice. I do want to ask you also about Gordon Lish. For those who don't know, Gordon Lish was a famous editor, was an editor for Esquire, was credited in the 1980s with either enhancing Raymond Carver's career or ruining it, depending on how you look at it, but a very kind of hands-on editor that many writers cite as being very influential in some regard. And I know you studied with him to some degree.
His classes, you would go at 6 o'clock at night and come out at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he didn't allow anyone to speak other than himself. He was fascinating, totally passionate about the experience of writing. People would be there on their respirators and having come fresh from dialysis because he made it clear that writing was the most important thing you could do with your life. You may as well just forget everything else. And he also respected how sentences were made. He wasn't really interested in a transparent novel, that is to say, a novel that is driven by character and plot. He was more interested in making something totally new for the 21st century. So it was very exciting to work with him. You know, he was interested in every single word you put down. And so I am. And as a poet, that's something that I was very familiar with.
And has that influenced your teaching?
Well, a lot of people really want to write the transparent novel. They really want character and plot. So I've probably been more influenced by the students than vice versa. But yes, I insist that I give them more very compressed exercises that force them to really think about how a sentence works. It's a muscly thing, and all those words just jostle each other with sound and sense. It could be very exciting. And they, you know, the usual student that you get, especially as an undergraduate, are not familiar with the possibilities.
And would you talk a little bit about your work with film and digital and that sort of thing? I've been working with Therese on a project for Prairie Schooner, a digital project, and Therese put together a piece on a magician, which recently showed at the Museum of the Moving
Museum of the Moving Image. Yes, it's the opening night. I'm so excited I get billed with Houdini. Well, Timothy was kind enough to ask me to make a video. I've done video art for quite a while, 10, 20 years, and all I really have to be is just asked, you know. But originally I was going to make something, you know, more Nebraskan, something to do with the landscape and so forth, but I just couldn't get my brain around it. I like writing about that. I wasn't so excited about the imagery unless I really processed it and you really couldn't recognize it. So I discovered my friend, I got involved in magicians, and David P. Abbott is a famous Omaha magician who worked with Houdini, with whom Houdini then revealed the secrets, his secrets, and in retaliation, like Houdini, he went around revealing the medium's techniques that were really plaguing the United States for a couple of decades. They made a lot of money fooling people that they could talk to the dead. So anyway, I think it's a 7-minute piece, and it's not a documentary, really. I don't really make documentaries, but it's kind of tantalizing look at those questions and how I feel about immortality, which is what magic is about.
And what are you working on now? What am I working on? Among the things that you're working on.
Well, I'm always working on new novels. I went to Yaddo, an artist residency, in the beginning of the spring, and I had three new ideas. And so I did 5 pages on each novel every day for a couple of weeks. So I have, it takes me 10 years to finish one. So now I have, I'll be about 95 by the time I get these three done. But it was really fun. It's the fun part.
Well, tell us a little bit about Pirate Talk or Mermelade.
Well, that book is written entirely in 18th century speak, inspired by Daniel Defoe. It's two young men who end up being pirates because really the unemployment then was terrible. And they meet a mermaid who is instrumental in the problem of suddenly having to join up with the pirates. And they end up in the Arctic. And I had written the Arctic piece first and then researched it, of course, in my inimitable style, discovering that there had been an explorer, Martin Frobisher, who was not only an explorer but a pirate, and he left some of his crew up in the Arctic, so I had justified that moment. And then I read a lot about mermaids, and in order to make, I'm not too sure about the historical references about mermaids, but Henry Hudson did say, and he wrote it down, that mermaids were as thick as shrimp in these waters. So, you know, maybe they're just extinct.
Yeah, one of our other guests at the Lit Fest this weekend is Carolyn Turgeon, who wrote a novel called Mermaid, and we were together at the Mermaid Convention in Las Vegas last month, or in August, and she's also putting together a magazine on mermaids, and she invited me to do some research into the 19th century mermaid, which was the whole mummified mermaid concept, and that people, it was controversial because some people would present their mummified mermaids, which were sometimes child corpses sewn together with carp or whatever, and presented as these finds from the sea. And so people really firmly wanted to believe in them, like you just, and whereas others thought it was a joke, and then other people thought it was just some this horrible tradition of digging up corpses, you know, digging up graves, or even finding living children and killing them for the sake of a mummified mermaid. So,
for a buck.
So it's definitely a kind of impassioned mythology that that I don't know. Have we? What was that about? I mean, have we lost that imagination, or did we mature as a culture? Or
I don't know. Every time I try to use the cell phone, I'm frightened and amazed. So I don't think it's gone away.
Well, the novel is Bohemian Girl, and it's a brilliant novel. I love it. It's my favorite novel of recent months, and I adore it. And I thank you so much for joining us at the Lit Fest this year.
Thank you so much, Timothy.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a program entitled Bohemian Girl, An Evening with Author Teresa Svoboda. This event was held in partnership with the Downtown Omaha Lit Fest. Ms. Svoboda was heard in conversation with Timothy Shaffert, Nebraska author, and a member of the faculty in the Department of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Saturday evening, October 15, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Heike Langdon, Kaneko Events and Community Relations Manager, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to sound engineer Rick Weiner for his assistance in the recording of this program. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.